Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost last week told reporters that a new state law legalizing hemp and CBD doesn't apply to recreational marijuana.
The Ohio legislature did not legalize marijuana for recreational purposes with Senate Bill 57. They didn't do it by accident. They didn't do it on purpose. Marijuana is not legal for recreational purposes in Ohio.
So take off your party hats, everybody. We're talking about the differences between marijuana, hemp, and CBD oil today. Dr. Joel Simmons is a radiation oncologist in Columbus and a medical marijuana recommending physician in Ohio. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
So this new law legalizing hemp and CBD oil, what is the difference between hemp and CBD oil and recreational marijuana?
Well, at face value, it's hard to tell the plant apart in terms of marijuana and hemp. And so that's why with the original House Bill 523 that passed that established Ohio's medical marijuana program, it actually included all aspects of the marijuana plant, which would include hemp. When the Farm Bill came out last year, the 2018 federal Farm Bill, it established a definition of products that are less than 0.3% THC as being defined as hemp. And so that became descheduled and is no longer a Schedule I substance. But marijuana, which by definition now is greater than 0.3% THC, is still a Schedule I controlled substance federally.
And at what point, I think one of the questions that came up was, how do you distinguish scientifically what the difference is if you're, I guess you don't smoke hemp, but maybe if you use CBD oil or something like that, if you're being tested for drugs, there is no way to really distinguish, right?
Well, and that's a good point. So I guess there's the testing of the actual substance, and then there's the testing in vivo of someone being tested for their job or whatever. So that's kind of where this hemp bill and a lot of states that have kind of rushed to pass their state hemp bills have kind of gotten ahead of themselves. And so in establishing now a hemp program in Ohio, what they didn't really take into consideration is how you test the substance, the actual medication, to determine whether or not it's marijuana, by definition, greater than 0.3% THC, or if it's hemp, which would be less than that. Typically, the testing that's out there now is just for determining the presence of THC. So something could be 0.2%, which would be defined as hemp, but it's going to test positive for THC, and so law enforcement and other individuals can't tell the difference. So what they're working on now is trying to get the appropriate lab testing machinery in place so that they can actually tell the difference. And that's caused a little, kind of in a gray area now, where there's been a lot of talk about not prosecuting marijuana cases, or at least holding onto the kind of backlogging any prosecution of them because of this inability to actually tell what the substance is.
Is this something that affects people who use medical marijuana?
So if you're actually a true registered Ohio medical marijuana patient, I don't really see where this has any impact. Let me add to that. I must add to that, an Ohio medical marijuana patient is registered in the Ohio registry, but also is purchasing products from an Ohio registered dispensary, not going to Michigan and bringing products back over. That's not appropriate use of, that's not covered under the Ohio medical marijuana program.
Yeah, so even if you qualify for it in Ohio, if you go and buy it at a marijuana dispensary, which is now recreational in Michigan as well, it doesn't count.
Correct.
That doesn't make it legal for you. You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher, and we're just trying to stay abreast of the issues regarding the differences between hemp, CBD oil, and recreational marijuana. My guest is Dr. Joel Simmons. He's a radiation oncologist in Columbus, and he's also a recommending physician for medical marijuana in Ohio. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What is CBD oil? I know we've talked about it before, but let's go over it again. What it is and what we know about its properties.
So CBD is a cannabinoid. It's the active components of the typical marijuana plant. There's hundreds of active components, but the most common ones that we talk about are the cannabinoids, which the most common cannabinoids we talk about are CBD, which is non-psychoactive, and THC, which is psychoactive. And your body has its own endocannabinoid system where there's receptors for this substance all throughout the body. Your body makes endocannabinoids, but phytocannabinoids coming from a plant like marijuana will be able to enter your body and react on those receptors all throughout your body. So CBD is, you know, the biggest thing about it is it's the non-psychoactive component or cannabinoid. The marijuana plant also has things like terpenes, which have a lot of activity. I equate those to what people find in aromatherapy, like lavender. Lavender has a lot of linalool in it, which is a terpene, helps muscle relaxation, things like that. So the plant is just chock full of these components that could have medicinal value, flavonoids and other aspects.
And, well, let's see, here's a call. James in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, James.
Hi, I've got a question concerning the medical marijuana. Someone is a prescribed medical marijuana user, and they happen to get injured on the job. Since they can test for, you know, the workman's comp will test for THC, is that something that would maybe rule them out? Or cause a problem?
Dr. Simmons?
I don't have to have you consult an attorney for that one. What I will say is that each employer has its own policy for their medical marijuana use. They should have a policy, you know, whether it ranges from zero tolerance, you know, any testing positive is not accepted, to policies that prohibit use within, you know, 8 hours of your work day or work shift. There's just a varying kind of aspect of a varying range of what policies are out there. And so, you know, it's you got to know what your individual work policy is, and you kind of start with that. But in terms of your specific question, I have to leave that one up to an attorney.
Okay.
Because there becomes an issue there, too, in terms of timing. You know, if you're someone who used on Saturday, you don't work until Monday, you know, you get injured, you're going to test positive. But you weren't necessarily under the influence. And that becomes an issue in terms of, you know, truly in real time being under the influence and being impaired versus having THC in your system, which can be there for a long time, for weeks.
Okay, James, good luck with that. And Dr. Simmons, is there a way to test whether you're under the influence of it? Is there a way to know that?
They're trying to work through that now. I can't say that there's a universal or standard way to do that right now.
Okay. Would it be something like, I mean, when they're working on that, are they working on like something like a breathalyzer that we use for alcohol, that kind of a thing?
I think that's one of the options they're looking at.
Benton Bodimer, you're on the air. Hi, Benton.
Yeah, how are you?
Good, thanks. Go ahead.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, so I guess a brief comment of sorts. This recent Ohio legislation is in line with the federal legislation from the Farm Bill as referenced. And one of the issues that I think we're finding, not just locally, but on a nationwide basis as well, is that there is de facto legalization of marijuana.
There's de facto what? I'm sorry.
De facto legalization of marijuana if you have no enforcement mechanism. And part of the issue that we're seeing right now is you have the ability to take a vape pen, for example, on an airplane. The TSA has said that's fine. They said a CBD vape pen is fine. Well, if there's no meaningful test to distinguish between whether that's CBD or CBD and a vape pen someone's taking on an airplane, there's no enforcement mechanism to the Controlled Substances Act from a national perspective. Distinction between hemp and psychoactive cannabis is repeatedly described as this 0.3% THC.
Yeah.
So it's THC by dry And that,
you know what? I'm sorry, Benton. We are cutting out like almost constantly. I'm really sorry. I'm going to have to take you off the air. But that enforcement piece that Benton was talking about, Dr. Simmons, is this something that you know about?
Well, I think that's where we're kind of at now, yeah, in terms of where we kind of, you know, as I mentioned, kind of got ahead of ourselves with bringing in this program. But now, mm-hmm, how do we tell the difference? And so I think this is temporary. I think there's different ways. I believe Attorney General Yost has actually just put aside like $50,000 for local authorities to start sending out the specimens that they're confiscating for testing. So it's not a situation where it's just going to, well, we can't tell the difference, so we're going to leave it alone forever.
Are these specimens like blood draws or what?
No, I'm talking about, I'm talking about the actual marijuana, okay, products and hemp products that have been, you know, people are being confiscated.
I see. Okay. Let's see. Mark, you're on the air. Hi, Mark.
Hi. I was going to say, from past knowledge, I know insurance companies that cover companies commercially, mm-hmm, if you operate equipment or things like a forklift, they require that company not to hire people who are test positive for the THC, because if they cause an accident, they won't cover their liability. So even though the recreational marijuana is allowed, you got to check with your company if you're.
You mean medicinal marijuana? You mean medical marijuana?
Anything that has the THC in it,
right?
If it causes you to wreck a forklift and hurt somebody, they tell the company they won't cover their liability. So that's just part of the equation that we have to work out.
Hmm. All right. Thanks, Mark. I appreciate that. Obviously, you can still have a hangover from drinking, and you can go to work, and it's the same kind of a thing, right, Dr. Simmons?
There can be some, you know, haziness or fog that people have reported, depending on, you know, what you've used, how much, mm-hmm, you've used. But, you know, I guess to answer your question, it's possible.
Mm-hmm. And part of why we're doing this segment is because of the misinformation that followed Ohio's legalization of hemp and CBD oil. And I'm wondering if you think that the information's getting out enough to people about what's legal, what's not, and why.
That's a good question. You know, I think there's a lot of discussion out there, you know, a lot of chatter. I don't know how many people are actually kind of like the caller you just had who essentially said, you know, de facto it's legal. That's, you know, I would disagree with that. There is this little, you know, kind of getting ahead of ourselves, as I'll say again, and mm-hmm, we've kind of brought something on board that we can't really follow through with. And so I would say it makes things really hazy. There may be a delay in some prosecutions and things of that nature, but I wouldn't take it as, marijuana is recreationally legal now because there's not a means to test. As I said, it needs to be sent out to be tested, and it can be tested. It's expensive, but they plan on testing. So I definitely, you know, and it probably has to do with quantities. I thought I saw that mentioned.
Yeah. They're looking for dealers, not casual users, right?
Exactly. So that's part of it. Who's going to be, you know, getting tested in this? Well, we're in this gray area, but, you know, in this world of technology, you know, this testing is going to be, you know, widely available pretty soon.
Dr. Joel Simmons, thank you as always for joining us on this topic. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Joel Simmons, he's a radiation oncologist in Columbus. He's a medical marijuana recommending physician in Ohio. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. An estimated 6 million people in the U.S. live with an unruptured brain aneurysm, and every 18 minutes, one of those aneurysms ruptures. Brain imaging can detect a ruptured aneurysm, but misdiagnosis or delayed diagnosis occur in 1 in 4 patients seeking medical attention. A new treatment currently is being used at Ohio State that could help. Dr. Patrick Youssef is an endovascular neurosurgeon at the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann. Thank you for having me on.
What is an aneurysm?
An aneurysm is an outpouching of the artery wall in the brain. The way I describe it best to patients is if you imagine a car tire, it's like a bulge on the side of a car tire. And it's asymptomatic, just as having a
There's
bulge.
There's no way of knowing it.
You would not know it unless it ruptured. Just like this is why the car tire example is perfect. You're driving your car down the road, you wouldn't know that you had a bulge unless you saw it for some other reason.
Mm-hmm.
And by the same token, when the car tire, when that bulge pops, you have a flat tire. In the brain, when an aneurysm ruptures, you have a condition called a subarachnoid hemorrhage, which is actually a very dangerous condition. 1 out of 3 people who have a ruptured aneurysm don't survive the initial insult. Of the other 2 out of 3, half of those patients go on to get medical treatment, which involves securing the aneurysm and whatever secondary treatment is involved, and they recover back to how they were. And the rest of the patients, the 1/3 of the original group, are somewhere between dead and normal. So whether that means that they're unfortunately bedbound in a nursing home or they have a little numbness and tingling, they're somewhere in that range. So it behooves us to fix these prior to them rupturing.
When you have a ruptured aneurysm, is that like having a stroke?
It is a form of a stroke.
Okay.
So the word stroke is a broad term.
Okay.
There are 2 types of stroke. There's ischemic, which is our classic, you know, arm weak, face mumbling, so on and so forth. And then there's the hemorrhagic stroke, which is bleeding on the brain. And that's what a ruptured aneurysm would be.
And when you have bleeding on the brain, are there symptoms of that?
Yes. Okay. So when an aneurysm first ruptures, the first thing that happens is the patient has what we call a thunderclap headache. Basically, it feels like they had a bomb explode in their head. Most patients will grab their head, scream, complain it's the worst headache they've ever had. Some go on to have nausea and vomiting, and others go on to pass out and become comatose.
Why does that pain cause nausea and vomiting? What is it about that?
The pain is so severe.
It's like with migraines. A lot
exactly.
of times people the same thing.
It's actually more severe than migraines. This is a pain undescribable. When you talk to a patient, they tell you it's not like anything they've ever experienced, and they have histories of migraines, or they've given birth to children.
Yeah, right. There's always that. How prevalent are they in the United States?
So somewhere between 1 in 20 and 1 in 50 people in the United States have an aneurysm in their brain that's undetected. That puts us somewhere in a neighborhood of 2 to 5% of people around you have an aneurysm that's undetected.
And is an undetected aneurysm, do people go on and live full lives with them sometimes?
Certainly. Yes, ma'am. So undetected, we only treat about 1% of patients because that's what we detect every year.
Mm-hmm.
So the rest of the patients walk around not knowing they have an aneurysm in their brain. The way we've gotten better at detecting them ahead of time now because patients come in and they have imaging studies performed for other reasons.
Okay.
And we tend to find the aneurysms when those imaging studies are performed.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about aneurysms today. My guest, Dr. Patrick Youssef, he's an endovascular neurosurgeon at Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center. They have a new treatment at Ohio State that could help in treating aneurysms. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Is anyone particularly more at risk than someone else for a ruptured aneurysm?
Yes, ma'am. So the risk factors we cite constantly are smokers, people with a smoking history, because there's an interaction between the chemicals in tobacco smoke, people with high blood pressure that's not controlled with medication, people that use illicit street drugs that cause your high blood pressure to elevate.
Like street drugs.
Crack cocaine.
Gotcha.
Crystal meth. And people who binge drink can also be at increased rupture risk for an aneurysm. And, of course, people with an extensive family history of an aneurysm.
So let's talk about this new treatment option at the Wexner and Ohio Health Riverside Hospital, too.
Sure. So this new device is called the WEB device, or Woven Endobridge device. So previously, if you imagine an aneurysm as a bulge, they come in different shapes and sizes. The ones that were most problematic are the ones that are shaped like upside-down soup bowls. Because anything you put into the aneurysm is going to fall out into the parent vessel and potentially cause an occlusive stroke. These aneurysms previously we'd have to treat with a combination therapy with either a stent and some coils inside the aneurysm, or we'd have to treat with open surgery. Now, I perform both, and both have their pluses and both have their minuses. The stent, unfortunately, you have to keep patients on aspirin and Plavix for an extended period of time.
And what is that?
They're blood-thinning medications because the stent is a foreign body. It's a metal foreign body in the blood vessel. And what can happen is the platelets can aggregate and cause stroke.
Okay.
So
they can clot.
Can clot and cause stroke. Okay. So we put patients on these medications to decrease the risk of that until the body intercalates that stent. So this new device is designed, it looks like a barrel. It's made out of titanium mesh. It looks like a barrel. And what it does is actually goes in the aneurysm. And rather than having the aneurysm hold it up, it actually has shoulders that push up against the aneurysm. Here's a little.
Oh, there is a. Yeah, maybe we can get a picture of this and put it on the website later. But that's interesting.
You're more than welcome to. And you can feel it's very soft. The device itself is very, very soft at the end. And what it does is it goes in and the cylinder shape of the device pushes against the walls of the aneurysm to hold it in place with these wide necks. And that device is thrombogenic. So what happens is that the blood will clot inside the aneurysm, inside the device, but not outside the device.
It's like a little netting.
It is, exactly. And once it's in the aneurysm, we deploy it and it just stays there. And what you'll see is over the next few minutes to few months or weeks, the aneurysm will just stop filling with blood, which secures the aneurysm.
Do you ever take this out?
Never. Never. It stays because what it does is it actually forms a blood clot in the aneurysm.
But it doesn't move around.
It does not. What will happen is over time, the blood vessel wall will form around those parts of that device so that it becomes a closed blood vessel again.
Okay. I'm a little speechless. Because it's an incredible looking device. It looks bigger than I would imagine it could be.
They come in all different shapes and sizes.
Okay.
They start from about 3 millimeters in width and go all the way up to about 11 millimeters in width. And then the depth varies as well. So this one, I chose a little bit larger device because it's easier to see.
Yeah.
It's easier to feel. It's easier to understand what's going on. But they do come smaller, actually. And I've used devices as small as 3 millimeters on patients. So you can imagine the 3 millimeter wide aneurysm is pretty small.
And what kind of success are you seeing with this?
So thus far in the properly chosen patients, I have had a 100% success rate with
this. And what is properly chosen? Who's a good candidate for something like this?
So location matters. It has to be what we call a bifurcation or a splitting of the blood vessels.
In the brain?
In the blood vessels.
Okay,
so as the blood vessels come up, they need to either T or Y or V off. They need to have a turn, two turns and two blood vessels coming off. That's where it tends to work better. The aneurysm shape needs to have a wide neck to it. So it needs to be at least no more than 1.5 times the actual width of the aneurysm. And then it needs to have some depth to it. But once the aneurysm is properly chosen, the device goes in and it stays in the aneurysm beautifully. And actually, in the patients I've done, about 80% of them, at the end of the procedure, you see the aneurysm is just cured. It's no longer filling.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Dr. Patrick Youssef. He's an endovascular neurosurgeon at Ohio State, the Wexner Medical Center. And he's talking about a new device, new treatment for aneurysms. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You were quoted in the Dispatch as saying it's a revolutionary treatment for aneurysms. Yeah. How was it conceived? Do you know about how it was conceived and who thought of the idea of keeping the aneurysm from moving and stopping from, you know, keeping it from filling up?
Sure. So the evolution of the treatment of an aneurysm starts with, first, the classic procedure is going in and opening the skull, going to the blood vessel and putting a clip on the aneurysm. So treating it from outside. And those procedures required you to do brain surgery, right? And I do those procedures as well. And typically these wide-necked, broad-based aneurysms are the ones that were best suited for open surgery. As time went on, back in the late 80s, early 90s, we discovered that we can put little titanium coils in the aneurysms, and those fill them from the inside like filling in a pothole on the road.
Okay.
The issue with those is they required a special shape of aneurysm to keep the coils in so they didn't fall out. Then we came up with more assist devices like balloons or other regular stents. The evolution from the regular stents was a stent that has a smaller mesh. It looks like a netting or a mosquito net. And what that did is it diverted the blood flow away from the aneurysm before, without going inside the aneurysm. You were outside the aneurysm. So the web device is an evolution of that, with causing the meshing to be inside the aneurysm, which causes the same reaction to the intimal wall of the blood vessel to sealing it over, but it's inside the aneurysm. So we don't have to put the patients on the blood thinners, and you see in almost instant results in a majority of the cases.
So it's a better recovery.
Yes, ma'am. So when the patient comes in and has this device done, they come in, I do the procedure, we keep them for the night, they recover in the hospital, and they leave the next day.
Wow.
Yes.
After something that serious.
After something that serious, we get them out the next day, and most patients are quite pleased that they had such a big deal fixed and they're out within 24 hours.
And when you talk about open brain surgery, how do you do this differently than you would do open brain surgery? I mean, don't you have to get in there, and how do you get to it?
So with the endovascular techniques, we can go through a blood vessel, either the wrist or the leg. Most classically, we go through the right common femoral artery in the groin, and we can track the catheters up through the blood vessels in the body. So we'll be standing at a patient's feet looking at images on the screen and driving our catheters and wires that far.
What drives them?
So they do have some shape to them, and mm-hmm. you can shape them. They have some stiffness. Basically, it's the internal structure of the catheter and the wire.
And the flow of the blood pushes
And the flow
it?
Of the blood pushes as well. Yes, ma'am.
Shelly in Reynoldsburg, you're on the air. Hi, Shelly.
Yes.
I can't hear you, Shelly.
Open the doors. Yes, I'm so sorry.
That's okay. Shelly, you need to turn off your radio.
Okay, I'm sorry about that.
That's okay.
You can go to the office and ask. I'm so sorry.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
I am. I'm a teacher walking in. Some parents stopped me. just a quick question. So I was explaining to the lady who took my call that my grandmother died with a cerebral hemorrhage, which obviously was an aneurysm. My mom had an aortic aneurysm in which she was treated at Cleveland Clinic, and actually it was the experimental research through Cleveland Clinic before they had the new protocol that they use now with the graft. But I'm wondering, being that that's my family history, what are, and they both smoked, which I don't, but I did in school when I was in college, which was 100 years ago.
Yeah,
but
I hear you.
I guess my question is, you know, how often should I be treated? Should I be tested? And at what point, you know, will insurance maybe pay for the testing since I have a family history?
Well, I would imagine the insurance is an insurance question for the insurer. But Dr. Youssef, what do you think if you know you have a family history like that? Can you be screened?
So medically, we can screen with an MRA It's a magnetic resonance angiogram.
Okay.
It doesn't require anything invasive. It's an MRI with a little bit of a software tweak, basically. And that can show us the blood vessels and whether there's an aneurysm located on them.
Do you have people come to you like Shelley who want to clarify?
I do, and I'm happy to have patients like Shelley at any time, and we can help get them.
And your sense about insurance, it just depends?
I think that if we make the case, if the family history is extensive enough, actually insurance has usually been very cooperative.
Okay. All right. Shelley, thank you for your service as a teacher, and thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Let's see. Chris and Galena, you're on the air with Dr. Patrick Youssef. Hi, Chris.
Hi. My mom was having some issues with her sight and had brain scan done, MRI, something, I don't know. And it came back, quote, okay, normal. And then about 4 months later, she had a massive stroke, a hemorrhagic stroke. And there was stroke history in the family. How fast do do the aneurysms grow? Like, I don't even know if it was an aneurysm, but, like, how fast do they grow?
Well, that's something I want to kind of get at, too, is that the ones that never rupture, are they because they never grew enough to rupture, or does it depend on the walls of someone's veins or blood vessels, and how fast do they typically grow?
That's a fantastic question. So not all aneurysms are the same. It depends on the aneurysm. I know that's not the right answer that you want to hear, but there are three layers to a blood vessel wall. The middle layer, the medial layer, is the one with the muscle in it. A true aneurysm involves that middle layer, the medial layer. That's what about 90% of patients with aneurysms have, that kind of an aneurysm. Those aneurysms tend to grow very slowly because the body still has some muscular rigidity to the wall of the blood vessel. Those are the ones that develop over a series of years. The other types of aneurysms where there's damage to that middle layer, they're called pseudoaneurysms. Those aneurysms tend to grow much more quickly because it's like having a wax paper covering over the aneurysm. And those do tend to grow more quickly, and those are ones that we do want to treat more quickly.
Are age-related ruptured aneurysms a function of that muscle wall weakening with age?
That is one function. Also, atherosclerosis is another function. And then the biggest predictors of aneurysm rupturing are size, shape, and location. So if the aneurysm is in certain locations, it has a higher rupture rate. The bigger the aneurysm, the higher the rupture rate.
And when you're talking about location, again, you're talking about the location on the vein and or in the body,
in the arteries
in the brain. Now, there are different kinds of aneurysms, like abdominal aneurysms. Does this sort of treatment that you're talking about today, does it apply to that kind as well?
It does not. This is only for cerebral aneurysms neck and above.
Okay. And as far as danger goes, you and I were talking off the air, things like abdominal aneurysms are very dangerous.
Yes, ma'am.
Why the difference?
Well, they're different size vessels. They have different size muscular layers.
Bigger.
The aortic aneurysms in the belly are bigger, and you can bleed from them at a faster rate. The aneurysms in the brain, while they're smaller, the blood flow tends to be more damaging to the surrounding tissue of the brain. Also, the brain doesn't respond well to having blood in it. It starts to swell, and the skull is a fixed cavity, so there's nowhere for that blood to go. So in the abdomen, you could potentially bleed as much as your body allows you to before you can't support blood loss anymore. In the brain, it's not that way. The brain, there's only three things inside the skull. There's brain matter, there's spinal fluid, and there's blood. If you increase one, you have to decrease the other.
Okay. So when we're talking about a rupture, we're talking about something escapes the vessel, not – do aneurysms ever just sort of disintegrate and go away?
Never.
Okay.
What you'll see sometimes in large giant aneurysms is that they will form blood clots inside the aneurysm. So the aneurysm, though it's an aneurysm that's 3 or 4 centimeters in size, it will only be filling a smaller percentage of that because it actually has clotted off inside.
Okay.
Those are still dangerous aneurysms and obviously need to be fixed.
Because the clot could...
The clot could disintegrate and then the aneurysm could rupture.
Right. Well, Dr. Patrick Youssef, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on, Ann. I really appreciate it.
Dr. Patrick Youssef is an endovascular neurosurgeon at the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. We'll try to get a picture of one of these devices before we leave today and maybe post it on our website. So check that out, maybe on Facebook. You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. So-called sound therapy is thought to reduce tension, symptoms of depression, fatigue, and more. But we're not talking about music as therapy. Debbie Penzone is the president and CEO of Charles Penzone Incorporated, and she's also an instructor and founder of LIT Life Plus Yoga. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann.
And Babajide Ogunmola is the creative director at LIT Life Plus Yoga. Welcome.
Thank you.
So we call it sound therapy. Mm-hmm. Who wants to explain what we mean by sound when we're talking about this kind of therapy?
Well, we had an event called Sound Voyage, where we also incorporated yoga with the crystal singing bowls and meditation. And really tried to tap into all the senses to really get deep into meditation, mindfulness, and that power of awareness using all of the senses.
When you're using sound, what's happening at that moment?
So sound can help just de-escalate the body, and different types of sounds correspond to different types of brain waves that will help reduce tension and reduce stress throughout the body.
What kinds of sounds are we talking about?
So often what we do is use binaural beats, but also using the crystal sound bowls.
Oh, okay.
They have different frequencies of vibrations depending on the size of the bowl that you use.
And where is the sound? Just somewhere in the room, or is it above you or below you? Does that matter?
Oh, it moves right through you. You know, if you could see those sound waves, it goes right through you. And our bodies are made up, 90-some% water. So it moves right through you and really hits you deep into those different areas of energy within you.
And how do you pick the sounds, creative director?
For the Sound Voyage event, we were able to work with this really, really cool DJ, Taz Rashid, and he actually programmed all the music and was able to put together different beats and sounds that work well with the body and was able to do a meditation with those sounds. And then at the conclusion of the practice, Debbie played the sound bowls, and sound bowls do come with different notes, and you're able to choose ones that do accent different frequencies and can just promote de-escalation in different ways.
Mm-hmm. And how did you choose those? How do you decide what to use?
Well, it's really, starting at the root chakra, grounding down with the body and then moving all the way through to the solar plex, the heart, the throat, the crown, the third eye, and really being able to move through that body or through the body.
And different sounds do
that? And different sounds, yes. They kind of, the notes reach into open those energies up and release.
This is a thing. People are doing this all across the country now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, more than 3 or 4 years ago, I was out in California at Deepak Chopra's and, doing some meditation and mindfulness classes. And they always use the crystal sound bowls or the Tibetan seven metal bowls to really get in tune and to really have that self-awareness. And I think using your senses can really bring you to the moment. And it can really cause emotions to release or to connect with your body and your breath with yoga or meditation.
Is this always a comforting experience?
The hope is that it should always be a comforting experience. But sometimes, as with any new thing, sometimes it does take people a little bit of time to get used to that experience. But a lot of the feedback we got has been really, really positive, especially at the Sound Voyage event. All the feedback was extremely positive from everyone's experience.
And how many people will be in a room at a time, Debbie Penzon?
Well, with the Sound Voyage, we had over 150 yogis in one spot.
Where?
It was at Vino Vecchio, the winery, a new event space by the fort over on South High.
Yeah.
And it was great because we used the sound off as a headset that we used that night. And like Babajide was saying, Taz could do the binaural beats behind us within that music and yoga flow with the crystal bowls. So it was quite the experience.
So they're doing yoga while they're hearing the sounds?
Yes, yes, yeah.
And within the studio, it's about, at max, we said about 36 people. And we do have different classes where the instructors may play the bowls at the end of the class. We also have classes where we use the sound off headphones themselves to be able to get the sounds directly into your ears and kind of block out any other type of distraction.
I guess when I first heard about this, no pun intended, I thought that it was more of a passive experience. And it's not. It's something that you're interacting with. Mm-hmm. Babajide, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And yeah, in some of our meditation classes, you could just be sitting there. But in some of them, you're also participating in doing physical yoga and then maybe sitting down for the meditation. Or you would have the beats playing while you're actually doing the flow itself.
Does the sound change or depending on whether it's a meditative experience versus a yoga experience where there's movement?
Yeah, and I think at LIT, our yoga studio, it's multisensory. So we not only have the sound and the music, we also have the light therapy as well. So in the beginning, it could be a blue lit room with a very deep beat that would be slower, you know, more restorative and relaxing, where then you could change the lighting as well to more of a red and the energy that would be more powerful to bring on more of that heat that you would need. So I think that whole multi-sensory, I just love everything that it brings because sometimes people have a hard time connecting to their body and their breath in that moment. So all of these multi-sensory elements that we're using really help people to be in tune and get out of your mind. I think that's the big thing, too, with meditation and mindfulness is get out of your thoughts.
Easier said than done sometimes.
Unplug.
Yeah.
And release.
Yeah. I'm always at a restorative yoga class. I'm always kind of jealous of the guy who starts snoring, you know? It's like...
that's me.
In one hand, you're like, stop. But on the other hand, you're like, wish it was me, right?
Yes, yes, well, yes.
How is this for people who are advanced in yoga, who are advanced in meditation? Who do you envision doing this kind of a thing?
Everybody. You know, we really want to expose this type of mindfulness meditation and just breath work to our whole entire community. You don't even have to wear yoga pants. You know, I mean, seriously, I mean, some people are like, I'm not flexible. I can't wear yoga pants or right. Da, da, da. I think, you know, that Babajide has really been out there communicating that, you know, it is for all. And I think they've really shown that, you know, stress and anxiety and people just need to get out of their head and be able to relax and release some of that tension and stress, too.
Babajide, how did you find out about it? What do you do as creative director?
My main things I do as creative director are really kind of designing our schedule and what classes we offer. And when the studio opened, the whole big thing was trying to have a wider variety of classes that would be a person that likes a lot of more high intensity, kind of more playful yoga and have something for them. Have somebody who would like more practice that's more meditative and then in between. And then we have the additions of our aerial classes, which also hit those ranges from somebody who's a more advanced practitioner, but also a beginner can approach the aerial and have a lot of great benefits as
aerial
well.
Aerial meaning up in the air.
In the silks, yeah. Off the ground.
Right. That's pretty complicated.
Oh, no. You'd be surprised. There's a restorative one that we have since you said snoring earlier. It's called the Deep Snooze on Sunday at 4:30 at LIT. And it is all restorative. And you are like a cocoon in that silk. And it is so peaceful. And we do believe people snore, but you can't hear them because you have the headset on as well. So right. Everybody gets their own little version of totally relaxing in that little cocoon themselves with the headphones. And even just a forward fold over the silk, It is actually like a prop, so it helps support you. So those people sometimes, that down dog might be a really challenging pose, that silk is right there to support you and help take any pressure off your wrist or your shoulders. Mm-hmm. And then also even pigeon pose. I know that was one of that Baba Jide was like, Wow, pigeon pose with the silk and the aerial is amazing because
how do you do pigeon pose?
So instead of laying on the ground, what you would do is be standing up and you would bring your foot into the hammock and kind of have the hammock around the arch of your foot. And then you'd externally rotate your leg at the hip. So you get that shape of the pigeon leg. And then
you're standing up
kind of,
yeah.
You can fold from the hips and then still get the same type of action with the forefold and the hip opening that you would get in the pigeon pose.
Yeah. So, all right, we're bringing all this is very multisensory then because you have that support of the silk. They're also talking about light and color, sound, and then aroma as well.
Yeah. And we really want to bring out, you know, that whole concept of life plus yoga. When we created LIT, it was really a lot about the life. You know, how do we take these amazing benefits off the mat and into our everyday life and world too as well? So we have a lot of labs. We call them LIT labs, where we bring in, really amazing people from all over the country to come teach and share their different elements of life and yoga with meditation, breath work, chakras, energy, aromatherapy, really to share all that those facets with our community.
When you first encountered this in California, what was the big difference for you?
I think just how it really helped me to connect and tune in on a deep level with myself and really be able to release those thoughts and really connect with my mind in that awareness. Meditation sometimes seems very far out for people when it really is just breathing and then noticing your thought and being able to notice that in that moment and let it go and be right here in this moment.
Now, Baba Jide, if someone's got headphones on, how are they being instructed?
Can hear the instructor right through the headphones. They have a microphone that
so that's incorporated.
Well.
Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering how that works with the sound. Do you kind of control your voice to blend with the sound?
Yeah, before every class we make sure we set it, and since the tone of each instructor's voice is a little bit different, we always kind of just tweak the tone a little bit just so it almost comes out similar to how these microphones work, is with a more pleasant tone that kind of melds with the music itself.
And the music and the sounds are in the background when the instruction's being given, and then they come more into the foreground after the instruction's been given. And
I think everybody's surprised when they experience it with the headset on and then instructor like Baba Jide, you can hear his voice, you know, how it sounds. And it really feels like it's personalized just to you. And it really does help you just zero in on yourself, too, and kind of just everything else fades away.
Not worrying about what someone else, you know.
Yeah.
If someone's looking at your thighs or your,
And within a class, the luminaries.
People are worried about that stuff.
Yeah,
if you've ever been in a yoga class,
it's
crazy. You're just trying to stay afloat.
Right. Trying not to fall on your face.
Anybody else.
Yeah, yeah. And we really want people to be able to just, not worry. There's no perfect pose. And, yoga is for everybody as well. So you don't feel like you have to have a yoga body to come in to LIT at all. It's really that body positivity we really want to support too. And even flexibility. I think that's the big thing we hear. I'm not flexible. I can't come to yoga. And I know Baba Jide is always preaching, that's why you need to come see us. But we have so many great props to bring the floor up to you. If you can't touch your toes, it's okay.
It's not the law. What's the response been to this?
Oh, the response has been extremely positive. All of our the sound off classes are going really, really well. Ariel has been knocking out the park. We've been really, really busy with Ariel. But the response has been fantastic.
It sounds expensive.
Oh, no. Are expensive? No. We're very reasonable for LIT. We're on Class Pass. We also have a 2-week trial for $25. We have 37 classes a week. And with that, it's unlimited. So a lot of our classes, Babajide did such a great job. When he scheduled them, you could take a power class, and then right after that, you can take a restorative class, yeah. Which is amazing. And then you could do one of our classes, regular yoga classes, and then right after that is an aerial class, if you wanted to experience that as well. We also have an open mat class where people can come for free and get to experience it, so at no charge. And a lot of our different memberships are really reasonable too. We had a different packages that you can buy, a series of 10 for $160.
So it's doable.
Yeah.
Well, Debbie Penzone, thanks so much for joining us to talk about it. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Debbie Penzone, instructor and founder of Lit Life Plus Yoga, and also Babaji Ogunmola.
Ogunmola.
Yes. Creative director at Lit Life Plus Yoga. Thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
This is it for Wellness Wednesday. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I know.